From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, the debate over how to best help the homeless.
We're going to figure out how can we help those that are in these situations with compassion.
Texas politics takes center stage at the Texas Tribune Fest.
We're living in a hell of a time, and we need something like the Tribune Festival, I'd say, to help us make sense of it.
And efforts to save the Texas horned toad reaches a milestone. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. House Bill 1925, a statewide ban on homeless camping, is one of the many laws that took effect on September 1st. It prohibits anyone from living outdoors in tents, sleeping bags, or bedrolls in spaces not designated as campsites. Violators can be hit with a Class C misdemeanor, punishable by a fine up to $500. Cities may not opt out of the ban or discourage enforcement of it. Cities like Houston and San Antonio already have similar bans in place, but it doesn't take much looking around to see it's not strictly enforced. And with a predicted tsunami of evictions coming, resulting from the COVID economy, it's not clear if Texas will actually get tough on the unsheltered or if it just wants to talk tough. We're going to have to wait and see. Meanwhile, cities across the state are looking for sheltering solutions. Lubbock doesn't have that large homeless encampment problem like the one in Austin, but that doesn't mean there isn't a large unsheltered population that needs support. Advocates for Lubbock's homeless are looking for solutions, and a newly created nonprofit plan to establish a homeless transition center has become controversial. But as Texas Tech Public Media's Sarah Self-Walbrick reports, existing homeless service providers say it's a solution without a problem.
Hey, what's up?
Chad Wheeler walks into the community center at Open Door. In a back office, two employees are ready to help the homeless people the nonprofit serves.
Wherever they are in their journey, this is a place where they can connect with what they need.
The organization is just one point of entry for people experiencing homelessness to get help. Wheeler, the CEO of Open Door, says that process starts with a survey.
They can do an assessment online. It's shared within a local database, and that assessment basically helps identify their needs and prioritize them.
The local organizations who serve the homeless population have used this collaborative virtual screening process for several years. Wheeler says it works. And the dropping number of homeless people in Lubbock supports that. Between 2016 and 2020, the number of unhoused citizens decreased by about a third. That's according to data from the annual point-in-time count. Still, a new nonprofit in Lubbock wants to try a different approach, turning that virtual experience into a more brick-and-mortar one. Lubbock's homeless haven would be what founders, like local businessman David Alderson, are calling a transition center.
Transition center is the piece where people have held their hand up and said, look, I do not want to be homeless anymore.
Alderson says Lubbock's homeless haven won't be a homeless shelter. It's a place where people in need can get help with things like mental health and job training. The Transition Center has had a few working titles. At one point, it was called a Diversion Center. The goal is to address root causes of homelessness, like income or addiction, and keep those in crisis out of places like jail.
We're going to figure out how can we help those that are in these situations with compassion and serve them and try to meet the needs.
Jerry Ramirez is a local minister and the current president of the South Plains Homeless Consortium, another nonprofit that's a collaborative effort between homeless service providers. He, like Alderson, is a director for Lubbock's Homeless Haven. Ramirez says the model is similar to other centers in the state, specifically the Haven for Hope in San Antonio, which city and project leaders recently toured. There, Ramirez says hundreds of people who are homeless can spend the night, eat, and connect with services.
To see what they're doing and to be excited about what they're doing and then be able to take that and bring it to Lubbock and to be able to begin to see people one at a time, just a holistic approach.
It's easy to go visit one facility in San Antonio and think, oh, this fits all the things I'd like to do. And boom, it's done. You know, I don't know how much critical thinking has been put into that.
That's Chad Wheeler again from Open Door. He's among those leading existing homeless services in the city who have concerns about the project. One of them is the method for addressing the root causes of homelessness. Wheeler's Open Door is a housing first organization. The Haven would work in reverse by first focusing on needs, then housing.
I know there are many, many, many reasons why that model is not considered a best practice.
For one, Wheeler says the housing first approach gives people stability so they can work on their problems. As for Erica Hitt with the Salvation Army, she's most worried about the location and possible duplication of services. Not all, but many homeless outreach organizations are within walking distance of the Salvation Army's downtown campus. She says even if some of those agencies have a satellite office at Lubbock's Homeless Haven, like the model in San Antonio,
they will still have their home base, and their home base is going to be in our area. So in my mind, that is a duplicate service.
There's more to it for both Hitt and Wheeler. So far, they say they've been left out of the planning process, even though they're the ones who directly work with the homeless.
This is what I do. This is my jam. I love these people. So anything that's going to hurt getting them housed and slow the process, you know, I've got to look at it with concern.
Still, as the project progresses, the Haven's Ramirez says communication will improve, but everyone has to be willing to work together.
It is key that we all come together to work on it. The little silos on the sides, those have to go away, because the way this is going to work is we're going to move forward and you may get left behind.
Right now, there is no timeline for the opening of Lubbock's Homeless Haven. Possible locations have been discussed, but nothing is official. I'm Sarah Self-Walbrick in Lubbock.
For Texas lawmakers, Monday means it's time to go back to Austin for another special session, their third this year, on Governor Greg Abbott's call is redistricting. Also, how to decide how to spend billions of dollars in pandemic funding from the federal government, and to determine whether the state or local governments can mandate COVID-19 vaccines. Abbott also added the anti-transgender UIL sports ban, which failed in the regular session. These issues and more will also likely be discussed at the Texas Tribune Festival, which also starts on Monday. This year's festival is virtual, takes place between September 20th and September 25th. I spoke with Texas Tribune CEO and co-founder Evan Smith about the fest and developments in Texas politics.
Well, the timing is actually the same as it's been for most of the 11 years we've done the festival, in that it's late September. We have had the good fortune, by which I mean in Texas, not necessarily good qualitatively, to have a lot of news break every time that we do the festival around this time of year. Hurricane Harvey, we've had the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, we had the Trump impeachment. And then this year, choose your adventure, voting rights, abortion, COVID, we have just, you know, it's David, Texas is the center of the news universe always in ways that are both good and bad simultaneously, right? This state never is short of things to cover. It's a literal fire hose of news turned up to the highest setting. And so the timing from my perspective is actually fine, because I think that there's plenty of people want to hear about, talk about, learn about. And we have assembled, as always, the greatest lineup of speakers to enlighten you, to give you insight, context and perspective, and to challenge your closely held views about these big issues, about the politics of the moment. We're living in a hell of a time, and we need something like the Tribune Festival, I'd say, to help us make sense of it.
So we're coming out of the regular session and then the two special sessions. Progressives would say the results of all that has been this dystopian present that we're living in. And we're going into the 20th. That's another special session kicks off with the Texas Tribune. Things are starting really to heat up with primary season. So there's a lot happening. There's a lot of people, synapses are firing all over.
Well, right. And let me say, the legislative session has been one for the books in ways that you just described. You know, I've been at the Capitol, David, for 15 sessions, 30 years, more than many people, but fewer than some. I've never seen a session like this in all the years I've been here. It is the most conservative session by a traditional definition of conservative that I've ever seen. And some of my progressive friends in Austin, where there are still some progressives, right, in Austin, will say, wait a minute, it's the most fascist session I've ever seen. I fixed it for you. And I say, no, I'm not going there. I'm not doing that. It is by traditional standards, if you look at the Republican playbook, they ran the table pretty much on everything. And they accomplished things that in previous sessions with wider partisan splits and possibly even more conservative members, they could not have imagined accomplishing. This was the Oliver Twist session for Texas Republicans. Please, may I have some more, right? Every time they turned around, they were able to accomplish more and more. They were not satisfied with what they had accomplished already. They wanted to accomplish more and more. And so the agenda grew, the punch list grew. And the Democrats, to be honest with you, were not worthy opponents in that they did not have the numbers to prevent anything from happening. You need 76 in the Texas House. They had 67, even if they held together. But the problem is that they couldn't hold together. And by the end of the second special session, the Democrats were fractured and the Republicans could pretty much just steamroll them and do whatever they wanted. The byproducts of this session are going to be with us for a long time. The changes to election law, voting rights, abortion, permitless carry, the ban on critical race theory. And I'm convinced, David, that if you ask 10 people who voted for that bill in the legislature define what critical race theory is, they couldn't, but they were able to get it accomplished anyway. And a whole host of other things that I think will change the way we live and work in Texas, the view that we have of ourselves and the view that people outside of Texas have of this state. And we'll see what happens if you know, chickens come home to roost, or if it's just basically people shrugging it and going, well, it's a conservative state. This was a conservative agenda, and peace and blessings and onward we go. Really remains to be seen what happens.
But the Trib Fest, we get the politicians, they sit them down. Or someone else who knows the issues will talk to them. And
right.
Typically, some of these conservative politicians of Texas don't go into the critical media where they have to face follow-up questions where, you know, they offer up their baloney explanation for why critical race theory is a terrible thing. And then when you come at them with like, here's a really good follow-up question, they don't get that on right-wing media. That's a great thing about the Tribune Fest. But I'm wondering about, you know, are they going to be there this year?
Well, we have a lot of conservative people from politics and policy, as we do every year. But we don't have all the people we invite, because you invite people and they either say yes or no, and you really can't force them to come. It's a little galling to me after the fact when we invite everybody in the world to come, and then when they don't come, people say, well, how come you don't have this person? Well, we asked. And that's an unsatisfying answer for the people who complain.
But it should be telling to us that they are not there.
Well, you know, Greg Abbott has been governor since January 2015. He has participated in zero Tribune festivals as governor. He will not come. He's asked every single year. I ask myself. I can fact check that statement myself. I ask every year. Does not come. And every year it's at the point now where I say to his press person, whoever it is, this is the time every year when I ask the governor to come to the Tribune Festival, and you lead me to believe that you're seriously considering it. And then, of course, you tell me no, because you were never actually seriously considering it. Dan Patrick used to come every year, and then he stopped coming because he thinks that we're fake news, or has said more than once he thinks that we're fake news. Of course, I say, tell me what's fake. Fake means something specifically. It means false. It means incorrect. Is it you just don't like what we reported, or you wish we had reported something differently? This is not just the lieutenant governor, but people who cry fake news, generally speaking. I say, well, tell me what's fake about it. Well, there's nothing fake about it because we publish the truth, right? But, you know, Glenn Hager, the state controller, dyed-in-the-wool Republican conservative, George P. Bush, land commissioner running for attorney general. Speaking to the attorney general, Ken Paxton has never done the festival as attorney general. Or I don't believe he did. Maybe he did 1 year as attorney general, actually, but it would have been very early, very, very early. I don't think he did, though, actually. I think he came as a candidate. We have Ava Guzman, the Supreme Court Justice. Both Bush and Guzman are running for attorney general in the primary. We have a number of very conservative legislators. We have the Speaker of the Texas House, Dade Phelan. you know, we have a number of conservative members of Congress from Texas, Republicans, Tony Gonzalez, Mike McCall, Van Taylor. So we have, and we have John Cornyn this year. We've had Ted Cruz most years. This year we decided to not ask Cruz, but we asked Cornyn. So we have a bunch of folks here who I think would fit the bill and will put themselves in that hot seat and be asked hard questions. I think that everybody, both sides, both parties, should be asked hard questions.
Beto O'Rourke is on the list of attendees.
He is.
But it's like everyone is holding their breath, waiting to see what Beto's going to be doing in the run-up to governor. We've seen Greg Abbott's numbers take a tumble. People are thinking this is the time, maybe, if someone would get up there and do a solid run. But it's frozen because what's Beto going to do?
Well, come on to the TribFest program and listen to his conversation with Kara Swisher of the New York Times, and maybe you'll get a sense of what his plan is. I'm reasonably sure that nothing is going to change between now and the time that his interview is available on our festival program as the end of day keynote. I believe it's on Thursday, the 23rd. But look, I think at this point, if he did not run for governor, that would be the news. That would be the surprise. Because if you talk to people around the state, fans of his and foes of his, they will all tell you that they fully anticipate that he will be the candidate next time. Democrats had their best chance to get back in the conversation politically in the last election cycle, 2020. No Democrat, David, as you know, has been elected statewide in Texas since 1994. That's 27 years. I have people working for me at the Tribune. Maybe you have colleagues in the same place who are 25, 26, who are in really important jobs, right? Are managing significant lines of business, who literally were not alive the last time a Democrat was elected statewide in Texas. And so from the Democrats' perspective, 2020 was going to be the election that changed all that. They were going to come close to, if not take, they were going to come close to taking control of the Texas House. They were going to win a bunch of congressional seats, including one in San Antonio that was written off by the Republicans and Democrats both. They thought, oh, well, the Will Hurd seat of all the seats in the country that should flip, it should be that seat. They were going to potentially be competitive at the Senate level, and then they were going to really run for president in a way that got them closer to winning the state for the first time in, I don't know, 40 years, 30 years, 35 years, 40 years. And none of that happened. Democrats face planted in the last election cycle. They ended up with the same partisan split in the House. Biden lost by 6 points as opposed to 9 that Hillary lost by, but still a pretty significant margin, not a close election. Cornyn won by 10 points. They won no congressional seats. And so the result of that is both the legislative session we talked about, where Republicans felt like we dodged a bullet, now we can do whatever we want, there are no consequences, but also there's a lot of anxiety heading into this next election. And, you know, the 2022 election is the first midterm of Biden's term in office. And that's always a terrible election for the party of the president, that first midterm. Trump's party, the Republican Party, got completely thrashed in 2018. Obama's party, the Democratic Party, got completely thrashed in 2010, both in Congress and here in Texas, because in the states, it's always the same as it is at the national level. And so Democrats come into an election cycle where they're already anticipating getting their asses handed to them. And there's no federal race at the top of the ticket, a presidential race or a U.S. Senate race, to galvanize their voters. So it's probably going to be a low turnout election. And low turnout is better for the party in power. And that happens to be Republicans. And then we haven't even talked about redistricting, which is an incumbency protection program, has been forever. When the Democrats ran the state, it was for them, and for the Republicans, it is now. And so it's not going to be a good cycle to be a Democrat, probably. And I think there are a lot of eyes and hopes are being trained on Beto, because if he does run and he comes close to ginning up the same level of turnout in 2022 that he ginned up with him at the top of the ticket, he and others in 2018, then they think that may be their only hope. But, you know, it's a really interesting moment politically and a lot of uncertainty.
And people who tune in, because it's going to be a virtual event and because of COVID.
Correct.
And COVID's
more than 60 sessions, more than 190 speakers, and we're pre-recording everything on the main program. There are some additional sessions for students and for VIPs and for members that'll be live during the course of the week. But yeah, lion's share of everything is going to be pre-recorded.
You know, and there are people like me and you, you know, we eat this stuff up, but I wonder, like, the casual consumer of Texas news. But when we think about how critical Texas news has become, you know, with the governor's handling or mishandling of COVID, depending on where your mask is, and everything else from abortion to, and even now, foster care. People are wondering, like, this stuff really impacts me.
Well, look, you and I both do work for the purpose of persuading people that they need to pay attention, right? What is the purpose of journalism? It's to educate and inform and engage people. It's to motivate civic participation by helping to create more thoughtful citizens, right? That's the corny version of it, but it's actually accurate. We are in the business of informing the public about things that I wish the public was informed about organically, but there are fewer news sources today than there used to be. And the ones that continue to exist are doing less of this sort of stuff than they used to. And there are many sources of misinformation and disinformation out there that confuse people and make it harder for us to just report facts in a way that doesn't, it trips us up in our ability to do that, or at least it gets in the way of our ability to inform people. People in public office have figured out that they can go around the media completely and just create their own channels of information distribution, and they do that. I think this is a really difficult time to be in the news business, but we do this work with enthusiasm and ambition, and yet we're also conscious, self-aware about the obstacles. And, you know, an event like this one is part of a year-long effort on the part of the Tribune, now in approaching 12 years in business, to embrace a public interest responsibility or mission. You know, we see the work we do as a public good, and it is for the purpose of informing the public. Public deserves to have a reliable, credible source of information that they can turn to every day and have them be told, this is what's happening. And this is what you need to know. These are the fights being waged in your name. These are the stakes that you have in the outcomes of these fights. At election time, here are the candidates on the ballot. Here are the issues at play. We have had a very bad, as you know, David, a very bad recent history of voter turnout in Texas, where we've been traditionally, by which I mean really for the last 15 years, 16, 17, 18 years, you know, 47th, 48th, 49th, 50th in voter turnout among the 50 states. And that's just counter to everything Texas says it wants to be. Texas's whole thing is we're first at everything and best at everything, and yet we're near the very bottom in voter turnout. And I would make the connection to the lack of a source of information that people can turn to so they know at election time what's going on. Low information voters produce low voter turnout. We want to try to counter that, and we attempt to. And an event like this, honestly, is part of that effort.
Evan Smith is the CEO and co-founder of the Texas Tribune. If you call it the horned toad, a horned lizard, or horned frog, it's pretty much the same thing. It's the same Texas critter that used to be so common across the state. However, the Texas state reptile is now a species of concern. There's been an ongoing effort to save the horned lizard by a coalition of zoos and wildlife scientists in Texas, and they've been making progress. Tom Harvey with Texas Parks and Wildlife explains.
I myself remember playing with horned lizards in my grandparents' backyard in Lubbock, Texas in the 1960s when I was like 6 or 8 years old. I would find them in the red dirt of the soil of my grandparents' yard in Lubbock, and it was such a treat. I still remember it very clearly. And you don't find them there anymore, Dave. In fact, they've declined dramatically across all of their range in Texas. And there's a variety of reasons for this. Certainly a primary issue is loss of habitat. The loss or conversion of natural wide open green space to roads, buildings, row crop agriculture, improved cattle pasture with Bermuda grass, and so on. So what's happening now is back in the 1990s, the horned lizard was named the official state reptile by the Texas legislature, and Shortly after that, Texas Christian University in Fort Worth, home of the Fighting Horned Frogs, which is sort of coincidentally wonderful that their mascot was what they called the Horned Frog or the Texas Horned Lizard, they began genetic research to study, could you move horned lizards from one area of Texas to another? Were the populations of horned lizards in the panhandle different from those in far west Texas, in the hill country, and so on? Out of that work, the Fort Worth Zoo began the first real program to captive breed and rear lizard hatchlings on a large scale. One female will have a clutch of dozens of eggs, and so they're able to release hundreds and hundreds of these little hatchlings at a time. For many years now, going back almost 10 years, they've been raising horned lizards in captivity and releasing them at private ranches, but especially on state-owned wildlife management areas. The primary place where we've really focused is Mason Mountain Wildlife Management Area near the town of Mason in Mason County, about 2 or 3 hours northwest of San Antonio. And there have been hundreds of horned lizards released in successive waves. These are captive-raised zoo hatchlings over the last few years. And the exciting news this year is that for the first time, TCU graduate student researchers determined that lizards released previous years at Mason Mountain have survived long enough to reproduce in the wild. They're actually having babies in the wild. And this is what we want to see. This is getting us on the road, baby steps towards self-sustaining wild populations that will regenerate themselves. The other exciting thing that's happened that's new in the last year or two is more zoos getting involved. The San Antonio Zoo now has an active horned lizard captive breeding and reintroduction program. The Dallas Zoo, and for the first time this year, the Caldwell Zoo in Tyler. So there's a lot going on that's very positive, but the Texas horned lizard is by no means saved. It's by no means out of the woods. And that brings me to really the bigger picture that I wanted to touch on. The horned lizard is a poster child of concerns about wildlife and natural spaces in Texas. And it's one of 1,300 species of concern, critters that used to be common that now are believed to be heading toward rarity across the state of Texas. So there are hundreds of other fish and wildlife and bird species in Texas like the horned lizard, used to be common. Now we're not seeing them so much, and people are concerned. This one really big solution that's on the launch pad right now, which would be an absolute game changer, is the Recovering America's Wildlife Act. The Recovering America's Wildlife Act is a bipartisan Democrat-Republican proposal in Congress right now with more than 112 co-sponsors. The Recovering America's Wildlife Act would mean more than $50 million a year in new federal funding for Texas. Much of that money would flow out in grants to zoos, nature centers, universities, nonprofit organizations. This is what is needed to really move the needle and scale up these efforts to save these species of concern.
Tom Harvey is with Texas Parks and Wildlife. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write on our show page or on our website at tpr.org. That's where you can find past Texas Matters programs to listen to, and you can find us wherever you download your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.